When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. This is the episode where Anthony is a little bit nasally because he's under the weather. Nothing pandemic related, just your garden variety flu. It's kind of a bummer of a week to get the flu because here's what I had planned for this week. On the schedule, it was Battle of the Bastards, my favorite episode. So I'm going to want to devote an extra long time to Battle of the Bastards. And then the final Ned POV chapter. So, of course, I'm going to want to devote a lot of time to that, too. So I broke it up into two different pods. This pod is Battle of the Bastards. And then Chad will join me on Thursday as we cover Ned's swan song. Without further ado, here is comic Steve Osborne.
What would be a movie that you loved the first time around and then upon second viewing, you thought, I'm not sure if this one holds up.
Wow, it's a good one. I mean, there's
besides Weird Science.
Yeah, Weird Science is not real close. I mean, if it didn't have nostalgia, it's not a good one. Could probably say a few of those Hughes movies, like I like Ferris Bueller, but you realize he's just a terrible person.
Well, sure. Yeah. I mean, most of the people in Game of Thrones are terrible people too.
Yeah.
Still enjoying the rewatch for sure.
Yeah. I watched Cliffhanger.
Did you? Oh, really?
Yeah. I rewatched Cliffhanger the other day.
With Sly.
Sly and Lithgow.
It doesn't hold up, huh?
Now I have to remember we saw that together.
We saw it together, and I don't think either one of us were praising it.
No, I don't think we walked away from that thing going, well, there's finally someone did avalanches on screen, right?
I was thinking that Inception for me.
Oh, okay.
Because I remember thinking, in fact, I walked out of Inception thinking that's one of the best movies I've ever seen.
Right. Right.
And then upon second viewing, I thought, I honestly got a little bored. I was thinking like, man, there's just a lot of like chase scenes in the rain, a lot of gunfire that I don't think really means anything.
Yeah.
And then I thought, well, maybe I have a problem with Christopher Nolan because I think
this is not the first time you've run into this situation with Christopher.
Yeah, that's right. So it's like second viewing Nolan. I love Nolan the first time, and then second viewing, not a huge fan.
Yeah, so interesting you brought that up because we've talked about The Dark Knight, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I rewatched it a little while ago. Like I just turned it on. It was on in a hotel. This is back when, you know, a while back, and I turned on the TV and Dark Knight was on. I'm like, I should enjoy this. And I'm like, well, this is a bit of clunk. and then Heath Ledger shows up and you're like, oh, hell yeah.
Well,
and then he leaves the scene and you're like,
I wonder if that's the sort of movie that you really want to start from the beginning, because once they basically introduced that movie by introducing the Joker.
Yeah.
And then I think that's a great hook. And I think you hang around because, I got to see the next time.
Right.
The Joker's on screen.
Yeah. Yeah. And I noticed those. It seems like when you're like, you tell someone they got to see it after the first viewing. And then and then someone sees it and they're like, I don't think it's all that great. And then you're like, no. And then you rewatch and you're like, oh, man.
Well, I told you unabashedly that Battle of the Bastards is my favorite. All right.
And so you did a rewatch.
I did. Now, there's always the risk with the rewatch that you're going to be let down.
Oh, yeah.
I'm never let down. I am.
Really?
I always walk away. I mean, I would put Battle of the Bastards up against anything I saw in Braveheart or Gladiator or Return of the King.
Gotcha.
I mean, that what they did with that, you know, Northern battle at Winterfell was as good as anything I've seen of that type.
So we've had this conversation about battle fatigue.
Yeah. And did you get a little battle fatigue?
Well, so let me go through this thought. Like, so we talked about this, I think, in the early going, right? And we talked about the original siege. And I was like, oh, there's some things I didn't expect. And then we get to the battle at the wall, and it's like, well, the big old arrow was pretty cool. And,
and then Hardhome. Hardhome was sort of like,
and then and
zombies
so,
versus a giant, right?
Yeah. And so like every time I'm prepping for like this will be the moment that the battle fatigue sets in, they do something real like clever. And I'm like, what? How are you doing this? Because I mean, by the time I got to Return of the King and Lord of the Rings, I was like, ugh. Honestly, I was so worn out. So seeing this one, I'm like, what are you going to do? Like, that's my thought. Like, I'm like, cause they start, I mean, this is all battle, right? You had two battles, one with dragons, you know, and one.
Not. Yeah. You could have, I mean, either one of these things could have been its own episode ender, you know? Mm-hmm.
Right. And so I'm starting this thing off with a battle and ships, which, you know, I'll be honest, I don't see a lot of that, right? You don't get as much of that, cinematically.
Yeah.
You know, unless you're you and you're like your boat fetish or whatever, you probably went and saw him. Like, you probably really like Striking Distance with Bruce Willis, even though it's,
I'll tell you what, boats. Man, if it's about battles, you got to give me a submarine in there.
That's good.
You got to mix in a submarine. I don't care if it's a medieval submarine or whatever, but I'm going
to. What about a battle in a submarine, like under siege?
Yeah, I could get anything with a submarine. We'll do it for me.
Okay. So yeah, so you're
and
testing.
To me, spaceships is just submarines in space.
And that's fair. That's fair. So you got dragons in battle, and so I was already like, you're going to have to really impress me because you know, I'm kind of Luke. I'm on the fence with dragons. It's getting warmer. I really liked it. I really liked the dragons. I love when the two other dragons come out. Oh, who would have thought that I would have been like, ooh, more dragons? Yes, please.
There's three of them? I couldn't even remember. I knew that there was more than one.
So that was a big deal. And then then we get into the north, and I was really impressed. I mean the trash compactor scene.
All right, we'll get to the trash compactor scene. However, I do want to call out, I think my general rule with this podcast has been downplay the things that I think you'll like, because I think I don't want to ruin it for you. And maybe sort of after the fact, upplay the things that you don't like so that maybe in retrospect, you'll like them a little bit more.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
Unless it had to do with like children, and then I'm just going to ruin everything for you.
Right, and then you know that I'm going to be, like, if depending on the child, I'll be rooting for it.
This one, I was like, Steve, it's my favorite episode. I'm not even worried that you won't like it. I'm not even worried that I'm going to build you up for it. There's no way that you can be too built up for this. So I took a little risk there. So I guess the question is, did you have high expectations going in, and did that affect the way you viewed it?
So I went in there with, you know, hey, this is Anthony's favorite episode. Let's see what you got. And so I didn't go in there. So that's how I went in there. I didn't go in there going, Stevie, this could be the best episode you've seen.
Well, you could have been thinking like, this is all going to be all about Hodor, Hodor time traveling
on a ship. It's basically time bandits.
Why don't they call them space submarines? They call them spaceships, but they're a lot more like a submarine up there.
Because they're under space? Is that what you think?
They should be called over marines. Uber marines.
Sure.
All right. So, sorry, continue.
So I was pretty eyes wide open. I was preparing to be impressed. It's an episode 9. So I already know that there's something of major consequence will take place. I know that it's John versus Ramsey. It's interesting the beauty of Game of Thrones is, logically, I'd say, I don't fear for Jon Snow's life because he just died, you know?
Because you don't think that they're going to kill him again, or because you think he's sort of something of an immortal?
I don't know that. I don't feel like he's immortal. I also feel like I don't think you're going to go give me 2 back-to-back seasons of feeling bad or feeling upset that Jon Snow died.
Sure,
I feel like you can do it to me later, but it would feel a little haphazard to go, well, we know what worked last season. Let's just do that again. So that didn't mean that I necessarily thought that he was going to win. I just felt like that was off the table, right?
The one thing that this show's taught you is that the good guys don't always win, and it's, well.
So the idea being that if John loses to Ramsay, he doesn't have to die. In fact, Ramsay might prefer it if he didn't. So there is that other element, right, where it's like having Ramsay be the he could easily capture John, and then now we get
turn him into Reek too.
Yeah. So that's certain. So there's a lot of all these things. So yeah, the expectations were high. One, because it was an episode 9, and also because you doubled down and were like, I don't even care that I'm raising the bar.
Yeah.
That isn't to say that I didn't have some issues. I had some issues with the episode, just some questions, some concerns. Wow. But overall, I mean, as far as battle things go, my Apple Watch at one point said it'd be a good time to take some deep breaths. So apparently my heart rate was going up a little bit. So that was a pretty cool sign that it was working.
Let's deal with your issues. I'm fascinated to hear, but because I feel like the episode was all but perfect. So I'm really curious to hear your nitpicks.
Well, my first question is, so Sansa, you're not even going to mention, hey, if you wait, I might be getting an army. I mean, she sent them out to all die by saying nothing. And I feel like that was a little, that seems problematic to me. It's questionable at best, right? I mean, especially because she was in there during the strategy conversation. We've already had sort of this, like, hey, you shouldn't go. We don't have enough people. It's not like that hasn't been discussed. And he was like, yeah, I got to do it. I just got to go for it. And like, she never mentions it. And I think that seems, that didn't, like, either, it creates a problem for me. One problem is either it becomes a dramatic effect thing. Here they come riding in and you're like, yeah, but she didn't just reach out. She'd already done this and she was waiting to find out, I guess. And so, and then she was gone, presumably to go meet them. So why is she not a good person? You know, is,
well,
she like,
oh, that's interesting. All right. So I think I may have a couple answers for this, but let's go through the litany of this first. So were there other issues about this?
There was, what was it? I had another. Oh, and then so they just, the other part is like, so all of a sudden we get 1-1 pounding on the door and all the archers are inside. What were the archers up above not like recognize? Like all of a sudden the hand comes through and it surprises everybody, but there were people like on lookout and they didn't seem to like, oh, dude, they're right here. You know? I don't know.
Yeah, he does kind of, Ramsay basically thinks they have no more people. Like, they don't have enough people. All we have to do is stay in the doors inside. Right. They don't even have enough people for a siege. And it's like, as soon as he says that, like, it's literally 1 second afterwards that you start hearing the huge pounding. Right.
Right. And that's where I was like, well, and everybody seems to be like, whoa, like they didn't have a chance to like start just like the top arrow dudes couldn't have just taken out at least a few of these guys. You know, it just seemed like they were just like, well, we didn't see this coming. It's like, well, where were you? We were right there. Like literally right there. That's your
job. I hadn't thought about that part. That actually has a couple problems. You're right about that one for sure. I thought you were going to say, why doesn't Bran do something besides run in a straight line?
Oh, Rickon?
Why doesn't Ricky want?
For sure was like, I'm like, dude, what are you doing? Just zig. One, like, as soon as you, I mean, I don't know if you can hear him let go of the arrow, but I feel like now's a good time to just cut left.
I think Ricky Walnuts
sucks.
I think he's learned a lot from squirrels. And if you like study squirrels, they don't do a whole lot of serpentine motion.
Got it. All right.
They run up trees. He's got no trees to run
true,
up.
True.
They will run right in front of your car. So I don't. Yeah. I'm not sure that he's.
I think another thing the show did well, and whether they intended to or not, was when he dies, it's kind of like, yeah, okay. Because I feel like even the show is like, yeah, we really haven't. I mean, you are upset in the sense that you know this upsets Jon Snow. You are not upset because you're like, oh no, not Rickon.
Yeah, no, I think you're certainly in fact, you called that earlier. You thought, okay, he's back. I don't really care about him except for what how he's used as a plot device.
Right. And I feel like that's exactly what they did, right? And I feel like the show was wise to not try to play that up. You know what I mean? And I feel like, you know, that for whatever reason, they just said, look, it's going to happen. And it's the cascading events from there, that's where the issue is.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go back to the Sansa thing, because I think there's a couple things we don't know. So first off, during the war council, does she know that Littlefinger is on his way up?
She knows she reached out.
She knows she reached out, but is she, I mean, she's reached out to a few people and they've turned her down.
Right.
So I'm not sure how much she knows. It could be that, like, she doesn't know until Littlefinger actually shows up that he's actually going to show up.
But where was she during this, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, she shows up with Littlefinger. I don't know. See, that's the thing I don't know. So let's assume that you're right and that she has some knowledge that Littlefinger is going to show up. I don't get the sense that her opinion really holds a lot of sway in the war room. You know what I mean?
I think John gave her that. I gave her the opportunity.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of her that thinks, look, you're not taking my advice. And so I've got a little something to play. I have a card up my sleeve and I'm going to show you that I've got some power in this relationship. So I think that she actually
to his potential peril. I mean, is that you can't say I told you so to a corpse. And that's the issue I have. She doesn't know that Jon Snow is this just, you know, he's Action Jackson. Right. I mean, she shows up. I mean, she could have shown up and it's just wildlings and Jon Snow's corpses everywhere. Mm-hmm. Like that. I mean, that
yeah,
was.
Yeah. I guess the point is that I don't think I think she, at this point in the show, her loyalty is to herself and to Winterfell. And I do think that she plays Jon in a way. I think that's kind of a reveal at the end of the episode, is that she didn't reveal everything she knew to John, and maybe because she doesn't trust John or she only trusts herself or whatever it is, but it seems like that's certainly going to be a source of tension in this kind of new alliance between the two.
Yeah, and I guess that's where I get a little bit like a little weirded out. I'm like, we're talking alliances. This is, I mean, this is their brother, you know?
Half brother bastard.
Sure. Only family she's got that she's aware of right now.
He says, I'm going to protect you. And her reply is,
no one can protect them.
No one can protect anyone. And no, I think what she's trying to say is, hey, your intentions are nice, but I'm going to do what I think is going to bring about my own survival and my own agenda. And it may or may not involve you. Maybe I'm reading too much into that.
Well, and I think part of this is complicated by the fact that I feel like we haven't had a great read on Sansa. And I don't know if that's intentional or not. And because we've talked about, like, is this a problem with the way that the showrunners have presented her with all these different ups and downs and stops and starts, or is this part of who she is? Because I don't have a real clear understanding of that, it makes it like, I don't know, like Sansa already is like so hard to track. And I don't know if that's by design, then it's effective because it's making it vexes me, but it also keeps me at arm's length from her character. It's the point where I'm not sure that I trust Sansa, and maybe that's okay. Maybe that's part of it, but I do feel like you've complicated some of these issues with them, but I kind of know where I stand. But Sansa's like, I'm like, does she have agency? Does she not have agency?
I was going to get to this at the end, but I think it's probably worth pointing out now is that the way that this episode ends leaves a really
odd
complication for Jon Snow in that. Okay, first off, who's in charge of Winterfell? Because Walnuts is gone. Is it going to be Jon or is it going to be Sansa?
Well, and I walked away from this going, oh, this episode is a big, to me, this episode spells the end of Tommen.
That's good. But let me round out what I was going to say before. So Jon's put in an interesting predicament because Jon maybe wouldn't have made an alliance with Littlefinger. Right. I don't know. I think now Jon is beholden to Mel and Littlefinger because they both saved him.
Right.
And neither of these characters are necessarily good characters, and neither of these characters are characters that Jon would have chosen an alliance with.
Right. People have chosen him for him.
And so Jon is in this odd predicament where he's kind of a leader. I mean, he certainly is a battlefield leader, but the question is he going to feel beholden to Littlefinger and Mel, or how is he going to navigate that alliance that he kind of fell backwards into?
Well, and so much of the show is about alliances and how fragile they can be, and about how you choose them and the complications of choosing them, like we saw with Rob and who he was betrothed to versus what his heart wanted and the ramifications of that. And there's so much of that, right? And it's like alliances matter. And
that's something that Sansa has learned. Yeah. And I don't know if certainly Jon has allied himself with the Wildlings, but probably at the expense of a lot of other potential allies.
Well, Jon was already, his alliance to the Wall was broken when he made the alliance with the Wildlings.
That's right.
And so then they killed him. And in order to come alive, he has some sort of a weird alliance with Melisandre. And in order to now survive this, he has some sort of a weird alliance. And so, yeah, so Jon, I mean, Jon truly is a bastard in almost every sense. Right. I mean, like, not just in birth, but in every station that he's in, even as a lead. And that's where his connection to the Wildlings seems inevitable. Mm-hmm. Right. Because they offer a solution that none of these other situations offer, which is you're free, dude. Do whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to be. Look, you choose who you ally with because that makes sense to you. And then you just live how you want to live. And that So like when you start thinking of rooting interest, it's like, because even this, he didn't want to take Winterfell.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, she convinced him that because of his alliance to the family, that he was like, yeah, but you never really brought me to it, right?
Well, and I think that the Rickon thing kind of changed his mind.
Mm-hmm.
So you said that this spells the end of Tommen. What do you mean by that?
If I'm looking at the trajectory of a show, I'm seeing a women in charge. We talked about the five kings, and it looks like we're shaping up more for queens. Because, you know, Dany obviously is now in a much better position. She's got dragon power. She's got Tyrion.
And she's got Yara, right?
And then Yara, who wants to be, she wants to be the queen of the Iron Islands. And she's willing to even kind of change. I mean, she's obviously hot for Dany, but like she's willing to sort of change their ways. You know, I'd rather be, you know, because, and also she can do that if she's in charge. So we're starting to see this flip on the female power side. And then to the point of Winterfell, I'm like, well, this has to go to Sansa. Mm-hmm. I mean, on one hand, she's either a Lannister or a Bolton, if you talk to Lady Mormont. But at the end of the day, she's the only living Stark that we know of. Even if Arya is still alive, Sansa's older.
So you're thinking that at some point Cersei's got to become the power in
either Cersei or Margaery. I mean, that's where it gets a little dicey, right? Because they are married. So if something happens to Tommen, then Margaery is in a position to be in charge, and then she has sort of the Lady Olenna, House Tyrell sort of brokers in the back. Or if something happens, then I guess Cersei could come back to Queen Regent. It gets that part is the political side of it that I'm not quite sure. But so now, if you look at it, now you've got that's four queens essentially that you would be now in play. I'm not sure if Dorne is still an option or not, but you know, with the killing of
So you could bring in Ilaria too at some point.
Right. So I'm looking at it from if you're looking at how sort of things are spinning, that's why I start to think, oh, the Tommen days are numbered, because this looks like, it seems like it's shaping up that way. And that might be more of just a, like looking at it from just a not necessarily the most logical, but in terms of the looking at it more of a cinematic universe sort of trajectory, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So there's a few things about this episode that I just think are noteworthy. So the battle scene where you're just kind of seeing all of these crazy random events happening to Jon all in succession.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I don't know if it's a single camera shot throughout, but it's filmed as if it has that feeling of a single camera shot where he's, you know, the horses are clashing around him and the arrows are falling down and he's getting trampled, and it's just like every 2 seconds something that should kill him happens,
right?
And he like narrowly avoids, and just the feeling of him under that huge scrum.
Oh man, that was
it's just sense of being trampled or whatever.
That was so well done.
And it's all right. So then they did this whole trash compactor move.
Yeah.
I think that they stole this from a move that Hannibal used to use, the Carthage versus Romans battle. So there's not that Hannibal or Hannibal Lecter. Although Tormund does at one point.
Yeah, hey, Hannibal Lecter's a guy's face.
Bite someone's part of their face off or something.
Yeah.
I had not seen that on screen anymore. I guess at one point there's just this pile of dead bodies and it becomes this mountain of dead bodies. It affects the battle, the way that they create the circle. And I guess that they borrowed that from some Civil War era stuff. Anyway, I mean, that whole battle was just, it was just one hit after the next.
Yeah, and you know really, and it creates some other questions about like John. It's like, is he good at this? Is he really a good fighter, or is there some magic? You know what I mean? Like, does he have some residual magic in him? You know, you just don't know, because we heard about the other resurrections that like it takes a toll on you, but he seems to be pretty good.
He seems to be pretty good at what he's doing now. First off, that first scene where they go to parlay and Ramsey tries to do his Ramsey thing.
Mm-hmm.
And John just has this sort of quiet confidence.
Come, bastard. You don't have the men, you don't have the horses, and you don't have Winterfell. Why lead those poor souls into slaughter? There's no need for a battle. Get off your horse, kneel. I'm a man of mercy.
You're right. There's no need for a battle. Thousands of men don't need to die. Only one of us. Let's end this the old way. You against me.
And he doesn't blink once. And you get the sense that this guy has no fear of death, and probably because he's been dead.
Right. And the fact that he goes and he says, "Don't bring me back."
Mm-hmm.
It's such a fascinating thing, because it's somebody who, again, he's been there, he's been dead, and he's like, I can handle it. But there's also the sense of like, maybe that's where my freedom lies.
Or yeah, maybe I'm not supposed to be here. I mean,
right. And so when you behave as somebody who doesn't fear death, you almost become indestructible. I think that's
The thing with Ramsey, where he sends Rickon out about halfway and he intentionally misses the first couple of shots, so Ramsey can get pretty far, or not, Rickon can get pretty far. Just enough to lure John kind of midfield.
Yeah, man. Heather the whole time was like, don't go further. She was as soon as he's
midfield, they shoot the arrows like over his head. So the only way to avoid the arrows is to run forward.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I mean, it's one of these things where it's like, that's pretty brilliant. And I don't think I've seen that done before. I was pretty happy with the way that I could understand John's motivations throughout.
Mm-hmm.
Like him thinking, well, who am I if I just do nothing? Gotta run, get my, you know, he gets really close to saving Rickon and then makes a couple decisions that are just like, well, I guess this is it for me. I'm just going to try to take a couple of these guys out.
Yeah.
And I mean, and then the scene that just gets me every time is when he climbs over the hill of dead bodies and his face is just covered with blood and mud. And he's got these kind of animal eyes. He's just got laser beams of murder coming out of his eyes. And he spots Ramsey. And at that point, it's like that he's not even human anymore.
Yeah, no, that's
he
true.
Is a killing machine. So I mean, I think I always kind of see John as something of a pretty boy or whatever, but in that scene, I just thought, you don't want those eyes looking at you.
No, for sure. That was really well done. It was very compelling. When he goes in and just taking the arrows and the shield.
I could watch Tormund stab and scream all day long. He's the best at stabbing while screaming. He goes in my sort of stabbing and screaming Mount Rushmore.
That's good. It was great. I mean, it was, yeah, like I said, I was not sure about a few things. The Sansa thing, and you know, maybe it'll bear itself out, but that's kind of where I was just a little bit like,
well, let's talk about Sansa's interaction with Ramsay at the end.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, something close to justice, or is this like pure revenge?
I think both, right?
I mean, I guess there's the poetic justice of him being eaten by his own dogs, right?
Right. The first time she gets some sort of like, where she's in control of something, I guess, and she's not had the opportunity to get this kind of revenge or justice, or hasn't seen it play out.
Well, yeah, she's never really, I mean, she never got any kind of closure with Joffrey, right?
Right. She's blamed for it, but she didn't get to do it.
Was it her idea to put him in with the dogs? I kind of get the sense that the way I read it was John was beating him to a bloody pulp, and then like he goes full like Good Will Hunting on him, and then he stops short.
Yeah.
He looks at Sansa, and because he's thinking, I'm going to let her finish him off.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it seemed like, yeah, this is her idea. She's decided that she's going to let the dogs eat him.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I got.
So that's a little bit, maybe that's not like Arya cutting off a dude's face.
Right.
But
yeah. But she leaves with a smile. And that wasn't, I mean, it's interesting because that's the final scene. And I don't know if we're supposed to be like, yeah, you get it, girl. Or if there's something else that we've seen a switch, right? I mean, that's a.
Well, we've seen this before, like when she walked down the steps at the Eyrie, mm-hmm. and she's got, you know, her new hairdo. And I kind of got the sense that like, this is a fully grown woman who can take care of herself.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was kind of like, well, foundering a little bit. And then after this, it's like, no, you don't mess with her.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And it's, you know, and probably everybody smiles a little bit because I mean, Ramsay sucks. So that's the other thing I was thinking too, is like, okay, so I was like kind of doing like a baddie checklist, like who's left, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we've lost Ramsay. We've got, I mean, Littlefinger's your low key baddie, right? I mean, he's out there running the show for his own end. Cersei's of course bad. The High Septon is, or the High Sparrow's bad.
Euron is out there.
Right? Euron is out there. You know, and how does this all?
And then, of course, the Night King.
Oh, that's right. And that's the thing that's always so incredible about this show, is that where you feel like maybe the number one thing, the number one threat is a thing that the show does a pretty good job of making you forget, the same way, like I said, I've talked about before, is that the same way that everyone gets preoccupied with all of the ins and outs of who's going to run what.
Yeah.
You forget the real threat that's out there.
Yeah. So the real threat is always sort of the last one you think of. It's like, oh yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. And John is normally the one who's sort of super focused on that narrative, right?
Right.
But this episode, he's got designs on Winterfell. I always wondered why they don't get one like a big telephone pole or something. Because
like the idea that they have to invent the telephone in order to do this. But.
Or something. I mean, give them like a big horse leg or something. Just anything he can swing around, because he's out there with his bare fists, which is fine. I mean, that's kind of cool. And at one point he picks up a big shield or whatever, but I'm thinking, dude, this guy needs a telephone pole.
Well, this is why I really, really like what the showrunners did, is that they go, look, we're gonna kill Rickon, and we know exactly what he's worth. We're gonna spend a little more time on the death of 1-1.
And Ramsay takes him out. Well, that's the other thing about that particular scene, is that, you know, Ramsay's using every bit of sort of battle knowledge that is available to him. He's got no idea how to deal with a karate chop in 1-1.
Right.
You know, it's like, yeah, they can't get through our walls. Well, let me introduce you to 14-foot Bruce Lee, because this guy is going to make mincemeat of your gait. I thought the score was amazing. I thought the music of the show is usually pretty great, in particular, just the sound mixing, the score, all of the themes were just brilliant for this episode.
Yeah, no, it was great.
Rickon gets to go sleep in the crypts now, unless he gets brought back.
Yeah,
that one. I mean, if I'm John, wouldn't I go to Mel and say, "Hey, bring back my brother Rickon"?
No, he's got the focus group data.
All right, so I'm on the record of saying I really like this episode, right?
Oh, I just want to say one thing about the Mel thing. I think that Mel interaction with John was real, real good, because, man, she is just sort of, she's just not the same Melisandre.
No.
Just sort of hanging, like, yeah, I mean, I'll probably raise you back from the dead. I'm probably going to do it. She's so just like, she's got like a can of Pabst in her hand, and she's just like, yes, I just, whatever.
So, any predictions on episode 10?
I think Tommen gets taken out.
Oh, and Arya.
Arya.
Yeah, Arya's head. I mean, everything is sort of heading in sort of this, you know, main central battleground.
Right.
Yeah. So your prediction is that Tommen gets killed? By whom?
I don't know. I don't know.
It ain't gonna be Cersei.
It could be a collateral damage thing.
Oh.
I just think, because I just, like I said, I mean, I'm kind of pushing all my chips in on, we're going to see, this is a battle of queens at this point. And I don't, like, you know, 9 has to end, doesn't necessarily have to end with a death or a major death, but that's kind of, something has to upset something. So that's where I'm like, well, we've already seen Cersei in jail, sort of the same way I feel about
Well, sometimes they will end seasons like setting up for the next season.
Sure. But a Tommen death would certainly do that. But that, like I said, if it's a result of like collateral damage, like if there's some sort of an insurrection of some sort in King's Landing, mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if we're setting up for a trial for next season or if we're setting up for a trial at the end, because I feel like that becomes a thing.
Well, I will say this without giving anything away. Watching this again made me think, this is sort of the episode where they start to set things up for the final narrative arc.
Right.
So you can kind of see seeds planted for, you know, sort of these final character arcs, these final clashes. They're not just thinking to next season. They're thinking at this point to season 8.
Yeah. No, you know, this, and so here we are headed at the end of season 6. Season 6 has been great. You know, I'm on record saying that as uneven as 5 could be, I really actually liked 5 quite a bit. So far I haven't really seen, I mean, 5 is probably the least, just because it has the lowest points at times. Aldorn. And so I'm headed into these next two seasons. I feel like, is this the time when I have to start buckling up for disappointment? Is it already? Is this where I'm a little like, so the end of season 6 brings with it two different things. One is, ooh, what's it going to be? And is this the last good hurrah?
There is a sense in which it's sort of like, maybe we should just end this now.
Well, I get a lot of credit for having stopped Dexter at the right time.
Oh, when did you stop Dexter?
The last episode of the Trinity Killer season.
Yeah.
So when he's holding the baby in the blood, and I said, this should be the ending of the series, and then I stopped watching, and I was right, apparently.
Well, I stopped watching Mad Men at the end of season 1. So, and I thought it was pretty great. I thought it was a pretty great season 1. I did watch all of Lost, unfortunately.
Yeah. I tried rewatching you Lost again, by the way. And because I was like, well, what if I just rewatch it, knowing where it's going, and maybe I can look for little Easter eggs, and maybe I'll enjoy things a lot further.
No,
but it became a trudge because I knew where we were going.
Yeah. So I stopped. No, because they had no idea what they were doing.
Right. Then you realize, oh, this is a jazz odyssey.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all right. So that's right. In many ways, I think that you could see this as probably the maybe not the climax of Game of Thrones, quality Game of Thrones, but at least the one with that worked the best. And maybe that's unfair to say because of my bias, because I just think this is the best episode. But I do feel like when I look back at Game of Thrones, I generally don't think about how much I hated season 8. I generally think about how much I loved, you know, seasons 1, 4, and 6.
Okay.
Not to say that there weren't really fantastic moments in those 7 and 8, but I do feel like this is something of a high point for me.
Okay. Now I've seen mixed.
So we're going to stop. You and I, we're not going to cover anymore. We're going to instead do a rewatch of Tiger King together.
Okay. Makes sense.
And then once we're done with Tiger King, we'll figure out whether or not we want. After we do Tiger King, we'll figure out whether we want to come back to Boobs and Dragons.
No, I hear you.
All right. I don't feel like maybe we talked a lot about Danny's situation. I thought that one of the things that I love about Game of Thrones is the dragon freakout.
Yeah.
Like someone who's not expecting a dragon gets to see a dragon and they freak out. Like I could watch that all day long.
And again, Tyrion seeing a dragon is never dull.
So the fact that, you know, sort of that reversal where Dany looks like she's in a weak position and then she says, actually, my reign is just beginning. And Drogon gives that little familiar screech.
Yeah.
And comes comes up over and just lands next to her like a trained, you know, Doberman.
Yeah.
And then she burns a ship, which I don't condone that.
So. Every ship is a ship worth saving.
Yes, that's right. But that, I mean, that was such an effective scene. You got to see part of what made this episode fantastic is that you got to see Tyrion talk Dany off of her original inclination to burn everything down.
Right.
And say, actually, this is where I become useful to you because I'm kind of clever. And I think that we can get out of this without burning everyone down. You becoming a psychopath and we can actually get some ships at the end of this.
Right.
And so you kind of get to see Tyrion be brilliant. And you get to see Dragon freak out at the same
time. Right. And then you get to see how they can work together, right? Like there's
Yeah.
Power and brains. It's great.
And Grey Worm he's just not great at anything, but give that guy a knife and he's going to do some.
Yeah, work. That was pretty wild.
He's going to do some work, man. So that was.
So this is how effective this show is. When the Dothraki come racing in.
Yeah.
I go, oh yeah, Dario's back. I don't know how that show did it.
Well, I don't know if you know this, but in season 7, they bring back Goofy Dario.
Oh my God, that would be the best. I would love it.
I would love that they bring him back and say nothing about it.
I would love that they bring, if there's two Darios side by side. And
they're just looking at each other thinking, who are you?
Or every other scene, the Dario changes.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
For this week's Bird's Eye View, I'm going to suggest that The Battle of the Bastards, a masterpiece, I think, in its own right, will also give us a couple keys and clues to solving the problem of how the series ends. You may or may not remember back when the show was airing, there would be these inside the episode featurettes that would air after the episode on HBO. And after the season finale, when interviewed, Weiss and Benioff basically said that Danny snaps. Now, this was not satisfying, I think, to a lot of viewers. And I think that there are multiple reasons why that is the case. But I will say this. I think that they laid sufficient groundwork for that to happen. And I think some of the groundwork that was laid happens in this episode. So remember the phrase that she snaps. Now listen to Benioff talk about Jon Snow's character in The Battle of the Bastards.
He is a deeply good human being, but he pushed anyone beyond their limits and they snap.
So I think we have an interesting Targaryen parallel here between Jon and Dany. In addition to that, listen to Sapochnik talk about his direction of Kit Harington before the scene.
The only direction I gave to Kit was he's not a human anymore. He doesn't feel any empathy for this guy.
Now, I had a lot of the same problems that a lot of you did with the ending of the HBO adaptation, but I'm also interested to know why the showrunners made the choices that they did and why they thought that those were appropriate choices.
Despite appearances, I think you'll find the city's on the rise. Perhaps we should take shelter.
The city's on the rise?
Meereen is strong. Commerce has returned to the markets. The people are behind you. Well, not all the people, of course. No ruler that ever lived had the support of all the people. But the rebirth of Meereen is the cause of this violence. The masters cannot let Meereen succeed. Because if Meereen succeeds, a city without slavery, a city without masters, it proves that no one needs a master.
Good. Shall we begin?
Do we have a plan?
I will crucify the masters. I will set their fleets afire, kill every last one of their soldiers, and return their cities to the dirt. That is my plan. You don't approve.
You once told me you knew what your father was. Did you know his plans for King's Landing when the Lannister armies were at his gates? Probably not. Well, he told my brother, and Jaime told me. He had caches of wildfire hidden under the Red Keep. The guild halls, the Sept of Baelor, all the major thoroughfares. He would have burned every one of his citizens. The loyal ones and the traitors. Every man, woman, and child. That's why Jamie killed him.
This is entirely different.
You're talking about destroying cities. It's not entirely different. I'd like to suggest an alternate approach.
Now listen to this commentary related to Danny's character after Battle of the Bastards.
I think Danny's been becoming a Targaryen ever since the end of season one.
She's not her father, and she's not insane, and she's not a sadist, but there's a Targaryen ruthlessness that comes with even the good Targaryens.
So here's what I think. I think that after this episode, the showrunners thought that they had sufficiently laid the groundwork for Danny to go full dragon and embrace her Targaryen side. And that is all for this week.